Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
This year's book in common tells the story of a plane crash whose victims included 28 Mexican farm workers who were being deported. Award-winning author Tim Z. Hernandez wrote a documentary novel, All They Will Call You, based on a song by Woody Guthrie, Plane Wreck at Los Gatos, Deportee. Poet, novelist, and performer Tim Hernandez was born and raised in the San Joaquin Valley. His books and research have been featured in the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, CNN, and National Public Radio. He is an assistant professor of creative writing at the University of Texas, El Paso. On March 13th, he will be at Laxon Auditorium in Chico to discuss his research of the 1948 plane wreck in Los Gatos Canyon and the ongoing process of identifying the 28 Mexican nationals. Tim Hernandez, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, your book tells about something that happened in 1948, and the San Francisco Chronicle says that your book is a stunning piece of investigative journalism and a lyrical meditation on memory, meaning, and the immigrant experience. Well, how did you get involved with this story, Tim?
I'll have to give you the short version,
because
otherwise, the show is not long enough. I was born and raised there in the San Juan Central Valley, San Joaquin Valley there, the son and grandson of migrant farm workers, and I've always been involved in the arts, and early on decided to take up writing and to tell stories, really, is the whole goal. The mission's always been just to tell stories. I had been working on a previous novel that was situated there in Fresno County in 1947, and as I was researching that, this newspaper article just sort of popped up. I was there at the library in Fresno, and I read the newspaper article, and it said it was very jarring headline. It said 100 people see an airplane fall out of the sky, ship plunges to earth, farm labor accident, and so I read the article. By the time I was done reading it, I realized that this is the very same incident that Woody Guthrie wrote that song about, the very famous song called "Plane Wreck at Los Gatos, Deportee," in which he talks about this 1948 plane wreck that happened in Los Gatos Canyon, and how when they were all the folks aboard were killed, they were migrant farm workers, and that the newspapers at the time only mentioned the name of the four American crew members and only referred to the Mexican passengers as deportees, didn't name any of them. And so that's what his song is about. And I didn't know that it happened right there in pretty much in my backyard, because I was living in Fresno at the time, and it was only, and they were buried about a mile away from my house there in Fresno. And so when I learned that, I was sort of just pulled in. My curiosity didn't allow me to let go of it. And I found myself standing there at this burial site, this unmarked burial site where 28, the remains of 28 passengers were there anonymously. And that's it.
You were curious about this story, and you decided to investigate it. In fact, Tim, when I was reading your book, I often felt like I was reading a Sherlock Holmes novel. And I mentioned that it is a novel, and sometimes I had to remind myself that because you do have so many facts, things that were actually based on truth. But it's referred to as a documentary novel because you have no way of knowing what the actual conversations were that took place between these people. But you reconstruct this, you reenact these scenes for us that make it seem so real. So how did you come up? I know that you, when you went to college, you didn't study investigative journalism in college.
No, I studied poetry. My degree was in poetry for both my BA and my master's degree was in poetry.
That must have been freeing, because then you didn't have a preconceived notion of how this novel should be written. So how did you come about deciding the form that your book would take?
Sure. I had already written two novels prior to this one. One of them was just a fictional novel, a coming-of-age novel, the first one. The second one is Mañana Means Heaven, which is a more historical fiction. So I actually start to see the progression go from the straight sort of fiction into historical fiction and then into All They Will Call You, which is really a hybrid. And in fact, it's cataloged in the Library of Congress under nonfiction. even though it is, I call it a documentary novel. I didn't want to mislead anybody. And the reason the word documentary novel appears in there is because there's a difference, there's a distinction between writing fiction for fiction's sake, and then there is also a sort of reenactment, writing a reenactment. And to me, that was the key reason why I decided to call it a documentary novel, because the way we watch documentary films, I'll give you an example, like say Ken Burns has a documentary film about the first sort of the arrival of the pilgrims at Plymouth Rock or something like that. You know, we don't really know what those conversations were like. We don't know how does Ken Burns know what the real first conversations may have been, except that we, as the viewer, or in this case as the reader, we agree to suspend our disbelief, because the exchange is that then we get to inhabit this kind of a real three-dimensional space with these characters. Now, what we also know is when Ken Burns makes a documentary like that, and I'm just using him as an example, of course, but when he makes a documentary like that, or a documentary is made where there is a reenactment, where we could not have known possibly what was really being spoken, we know that there are scholars and there are experts behind that who are giving us the closest rendering to what was really happening. And in the case of the plane wreck at Los Gatos, I consider myself the scholar and the person who is the expert on, who has the most information, who can create a reenactment in a way that tells you the closest of what could have possibly been. So the way that that looks in my book is, there's, like, for example, the character of Guadalupe, who is taking a photograph with his wife, Micaela. Now, Guadalupe was one of the passengers who was killed. I know his family personally. I visited his actual home in Charco de Pantoja, the home that he was born and raised in, the home that he left to his family. I've interviewed people who still knew him when he was alive at the time. And so whenever I create a sort of reenactment with him, having him sort of have his dialogue in there, it comes from the testimony of his friends and family. They told me Guadalupe used to talk like this, and he would say this, and he was concerned with this. So those were reenactments that I would recreate. So that's different than just basically, you know, giving him language so that he has a character, so he's a character. That's the difference to me. That's the distinction there. And I do that, and I would honestly say probably about, you know, there's a very small portion of the book that is quote-unquote fictional, or, you know, a reenactment in that way, because the largest majority of the book is actually nonfiction, and that's why it has that catalog filing there at the Library of Congress. It's really a nonfiction book, but I had to find ways. I didn't want to just create a book that people could read and say, hey, that's an interesting story. I wanted to create a book that brought these people to life again so that the reader can inhabit this real space with them and feel like they're real people, because they were.
My guest is Tim Z. Hernandez, and he has written it's sometimes called, I think, historical fiction, and mm-hmm. The title is All They Will Call You. And you became interested in this when you first learned about this plane crash in, what, 2010?
Yeah, that's right.
So this has been an evolving process and of figuring out who these people were. What did you have to go on?
At first, it was just instinct for the first 2 years, my gut instinct and, you know, just my plain curiosity, kind of sleuthing around Fresno using the resources I had. I had been working in the nonprofit sector for about 17 years, so I had a lot of contacts there with historical societies and groups like that. And then, you know, once I kind of started to give up on the idea of trying to locate any of the family members, I turned to the local bilingual newspaper, Vida en el Valle, which is, I think it distributes between Bakersfield and Sacramento, that area. And that newspaper is what ended up in the hands of one of the families. The first family was the Ramirez family, a man named Jaime Ramirez there in Fresno. And he contacted me.
Took a shotgun approach and said, well, I'll just shoot this out.
That's right.
And just keep my fingers crossed that somebody will see it.
And it was a long shot because, for one, you know, it's a newspaper that comes out weekly. So, you know, it only comes out once a week, every Wednesday. And then, of course, you know, it would have to assume that the person reading it is that the family member would be in this area where this is being distributed. And, of course, then there's also, they have to actually pick up that paper that one time it comes out in the week. So it was a long shot. I knew it, but it worked. And when I found the Ramirez family, they gave me the clue. Jaime Ramirez gave me the clue, the single shred of newspaper that allowed me then to go on and find the other family members. It was, he had in his hands the original newspaper that was sent to his family in 1948. It was actually a Spanish language newspaper printed only for the Mexican community in Fresno, an independent newspaper. And that newspaper was called El Faro, and it had the names of every passenger It had the hometown in Mexico of every passenger who was killed. It had even their the surviving family, their relatives, their names were in that of every passenger that was killed. That's how I began to find more families. It was because of that newspaper that the Ramirez family had.
Well, let's remind people where we're talking about, because if they tune in and hear Los Gatos, we want to be clear that this is not the city of Los Gatos, but this is a valley near Colinga. And when it happened, the newspaper there, the Colinga Record, was the first to report it. And you have a colorful character, Mac, one of the characters in the early stages of this crash. I don't know if you said when this exactly happened. I think we said 1948, but precisely when?
Yeah, January 28th.
January 28th of 1948. And you have, you were able to determine at what hour each of these things happened as people learned about this crash. There was something that was just so poignant, Tim, that you learned about the pilot, this man named Frankie, and his wife. And most people's, I mean, if there's a pilot, their wife don't fly along with them in any official capacity. So how was it that Frankie's wife happened to be on that flight?
You know, that's one of those auspicious, well, maybe not auspicious, but very curious alignments, circumstances. You know, I spoke with Frank's sisters, Helen and Mary Lou, and also Frank's niece, Connie. And, you know, they kind of conveyed to me the story of how that happened. And one of the ways was that, well, what happened was that that morning, Frank actually had a stewardess who was always assigned to him that would fly with on these sort of, you know, these kind of, these tasks that they'd go flying around. And he had a stewardess he worked with. But that stewardess called in sick that morning. According to the family, she had been hungover because she was at a wedding the night before. So they knew that detail. And she called in that morning and said, you know, I'm calling in sick. I can't do it. And so the airline company there asked Frank, would your wife come? Would your wife agree to come? And I guess at the time it was, you know, customary that they had a stewardess aboard for these kinds of flights. And so he said, you know, yeah, you know, let me ask her. And sure enough, he asked his wife, and Bobby Atkinson said, yeah. And that was, she went with him, and he convinced her by telling her that it was a very short flight, just a quick sort of half-day trip, and they'd be home by dinner. And, you know, what's most sort of interesting is that 2 weeks prior to that flight, to that day, Bobby had been speaking with her sister-in-laws, Mary Lou and Helen, and Frank's family back in Rochester by phone. And Bobby said to them, you know, if anything were to ever to happen to Frankie, I'd want to be with him. Because,
you know,
he had always sort of,
as I recall, his mother was afraid of planes anyway, afraid of flying. And she was so concerned about her son because of her own fear of being up in an airplane. And so this fear is like, gosh, something might happen to Frankie. And this is when his wife said, well, if anything does happen to him, I want to be with him.
Yeah, and you know, Frankie had also, you know, and there was a genuine concern. There was a very genuine concern for Frankie because, you know, he had gone through World War II, had flown that same type of airplane, the Douglas DC-3, during World War II over the most treacherous terrain there known to any pilot. It was a hump, the India-Burma hump, and he had actually crash landed a Douglas DC-3 two times before because of engine failure. And one time that one of the sisters said to me, you know, he had such a reputation that one time Frankie was actually, he was flying a cargo load of fine china over the hump, and he crash landed that thing with one engine, and he didn't break a single dish. So, you know, that was his legacy, according to his sister. And so, you know, if there was any pilot who was familiar with that airplane, who had flown thousands of hours in that airplane, it was Frank Atkinson. He knew that airplane very well. It was just one of those things that when it's your time.
My guest is Tim Hernandez, who is this year's Book in Common author. His book is All They Will Call You, and he will be in Lackson Auditorium on March 13th. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is Tim Hernandez, who wrote this year's book In Common, which tells the story of a plane crash whose victims included 28 Mexican farm workers who were being deported. You know, I was surprised to learn, because I assumed they would send these deportees back to Mexico by bus, train, and I was surprised that they used airplanes to deport people. Mm-hmm. And apparently that was fairly new at that time in 1948.
That's correct, yeah. Well, they had the surplus of these Douglas DC-3 airplanes. This was right after World War II had ended now, and what they were doing was pretty much, you know, refitting them and with seats, and you know, giving them new paint jobs, and using them here, you know, just using them here to transport, you know, cargo and also people. So that's what this airplane was doing. It was being used for that.
Well, your own preparation for writing this book, you mentioned your previous books. You have five previous books. Served you as preparation for this one, and how was that, Tim?
You know, because this book was so, it had so many different components to it. This book is, it's also a book about music. It's also a book about the power of art, you know, the power of art. Because, you know, this plane wreck at Los Gatos would have been buried in history had it not been for Woody Guthrie hearing about it and writing a poem based on it. So he wrote a poem first based on this accident. And then that poem was picked up 9 years later by a young college student in Fort Collins, Colorado, who turned it into a song. So you have poetry, then you have a song, and that song sailed across, across space and time for the last 60 something years, and it found me, and now it's becoming a book. So it's really about the power of art, also, and then there's also these testimonies of family members, there are interviews, there's documents, newspaper accounts. So there's so many textures in this book that. What I have been doing, prior to writing this book, in the last 20-some years of my career, is I have a background in music, in theater and music collaboration. I have a background in visual art, looking at things from a visual aspect. I have a background in writing poetry and fiction, and now historical fiction. So all of those came into play when I was putting the book together, every one of those. How do images look when used inside of this narrative? How do I place language on the page so that it conveys the way an accident might look when it scatters across the page? Or, you know, so I was able to use all of these tools in my toolbox to write this book. It took everything I had, and I really feel like this is the book I was meant to write.
My guest is Tim Z. Hernandez, and his book is one of historical fiction, All They Will Call You. And in the process of investigating this, and you learn the role that this music, this poem by Woody Guthrie played, and you actually got to interview one of the giants of folk music, Tim. I'm so impressed that you got to interview Pete Seeger.
Yeah, I sure did. That was a highlight of my life, one of my highlights for sure.
You were able to kind of set him straight. His memory wasn't very clear about who actually wrote the music.
Yeah, initially it wasn't. No, he kind of was just kind of, I think kind of went into autopilot and tried to tell it as what best as he knew. And then all of a sudden I corrected him briefly. And then he said, oh, that's exactly right. You know, what happened is that, I didn't actually think I would get to meet Pete Seeger, interview him. I knew that that was always one of the goals. But I guess it was so far-fetched to me, I didn't think it would be possible ever. And it was really, again, this kind of almost a sort of synchronicity that happened. It was in New York. I had sent him to his fan mail, basically a letter, a handwritten letter, and showing him some newspaper articles about the research I was doing. And anyways, I didn't hear from him for a couple of weeks, maybe a month. And then one day, I was at the Brooklyn Book Festival, all the way from California at the time. No, I was in Colorado. I flew out to New York. I'm at the Brooklyn Book Festival. I'm walking up Manhattan, taking a break from the festival, and all of a sudden my phone rings out of the blue. And I don't recognize the number, so I let it go to voicemail. I'm like, I don't know who that is. So I let it go to voicemail. And then I check my voicemail right after, and the voice says, this is Pete Seeger. I'm looking for Tim Hernandez. If you're ever in New York, here's my number. Call me. And I was like, I'm standing in New York at that time. So I called him right away, and by the next morning, I was with his grandson, who lived in New York, there in Manhattan. His grandson drove me up to his house to meet with his grandfather, and a few other people there were part of this little group of us, and we went up to visit Pete Seeger. I sat down with him, and right away he had questions for me about, you know, how did I find them, and I had questions for him as well. And really, what I wanted to know was, what was his version of how this Woody Guthrie's lyrics became a song? I wanted to confirm what I had already heard from Martin Hoffman's family and friends. And Pete Seeger at first started to say, you're right. He said, you know, my memory's a little blurry. He said, but Woody wrote it and Woody came to sing it. And then I said, wait a minute, Pete, I heard is there a man named Martin Hoffman? And then he says, that's right. I'm sorry. Woody didn't write that song. Martin Hoffman wrote it. And then he conveyed to me the story that Martin Hoffman's family told me also, or at least the lore among the friends.
Well, you know, at times when I hear your story and this whole process, the evolution of this book and the story, it seems like you have a charmed life, Tim. You get this phone call from Pete Seeger, and you're right there in New York when you get the phone call. And then another time, you're trying to track down this grandson of Jaime Ramirez, I believe it was, and you're trying to track him down, and when you talk to him and you find out where he is, and it turns out he's in Fresno, where you are. And then they tell you, well, we have a restaurant. And you say, well, where is this restaurant? And they say Shaw and Blackstone. And anybody who's ever been to Fresno, you cannot avoid that intersection of Shaw and Blackstone.
Right, right.
And so there they were, right there in your backyard, that you could go talk to them.
And it was a restaurant I had gone to since I was a kid. My parents, we went to that restaurant since I was a little boy. So I knew that restaurant very well. I had been there in front of them many, many times. Yeah, it's incredible. There are so many synchronicities like that, just timeliness of things that I just, you know, and I couldn't, and I think, I thought to myself, how do I even write those into the book? Because that's an interesting sort of component to it, sort of the magic behind all of this. And I just, at some point, I just said, you know, I think people will either see through it or they won't. Like, there's no way you can write it all. I think it would be unbelievable if I wrote that many. You know, there were moments where I would meet family, I would contact a family who had the last story of one of the passengers, and I finally find a family, and I contact them that night. And one time I contacted this family, and they said, you just missed us. Last night my uncle died. He passed away. You know, and so, like, families that I was just on the heels of getting these final stories from about who these folks were, and they had, you know, either passed away just 24 hours before, or I just missed them, and, you know, that happens so often as well. And so this story it's an old story. It happened 71 years ago. So the people who are alive, who still hold this history, they are fading fast, and so there is a sort of sense of timeliness to this. I'm rushing, and it's urgent to get all the stories I can.
I might remind listeners that your book is about a plane crash in 1948, and the victims included 28 Mexican farm workers who were being deported, and also there were crew members, the pilot. So there were a total of 32 passengers who died in this plane crash. And another thing that comes to mind is, Tim, this gets expensive. If you've learned you're going to have to make a trip to Mexico, but you had been hired by the University of Texas, and so they, in a sense, helped out in this research. And how did they help?
You know what? They did. They did. They came in 2014 when I got a job there here at UTEP, where I'm at now, at the University of Texas here in El Paso. In 2014, they gave me some research money, so that was really helpful. But prior to that, from 2010 to 2014, I wasn't funded by anybody. It was just from my own pocket, and I had to kind of get creative with, you know, how to get from place to place. Like I said, fortunately, I had some books out by then. So what I would do sometimes is, without having money, or any kind of budget to research, to go looking around, what I would do is I would, like, if I found out there was a family in, I don't know, Bay City, Texas, I would actually contact the local university that was close by there, and I'd say, hey, I'm Tim Hernandez, I'm an author. You know, I'd come out for just the price of a flight, you know, and they would have me come to that university. I would rent a car, and then I would spend 2 days driving over to this town trying to talk to these families. So I was trying to make use of whatever I had at my disposal, any resources I had, to try and, you know, do some of the research. Sometimes, you know, and this story is so vast, there are so many people in it, that I found out that pretty much anywhere I was invited to as an author, that I could find some part of the story located nearby. You know, I was living in Colorado. I found out that Martin Hoffman lived in Fort Collins, Colorado, when he first recorded the song by Gerald to Fort Collins. I found out that, you know, he had a girlfriend who lived on the other side, almost by Utah. So I drove over to Utah and hung out there. Like, so I was always within proximity of some part of this history, and I just made the most use of it. Prior to 2014, after 2014, like I said, UTEP gave me some money, and the money was specifically to travel into Mexico and to conduct more research there. And that's what I did in 2014 and 2015, went into Mexico and did more of the research there. Yeah.
My guest is Tim Z. Hernandez. His book is All They Will Call You. And you researched this over a period of years, and you could travel here in the United States, but when you're getting ready to go to Mexico, you need a little more than just travel expenses, because you actually, you say, yeah. Tim, this is your word, mm-hmm. your Spanish is terrible.
Yep.
So you had
That's
to have,
right.
you had pay a staff. You had a staff, I'm going to call it that, when you went to Mexico. So that's why it helped to have a little funding. And who were your staff members, Tim?
Yeah, well, you know, my research team was wonderful how that happened. You know, when I first met the Ramirez family, the first thing that Jaime Ramirez's brother, a wonderful man named Guillermo Ramirez, Guillermo said to me, Tim, if you're, and Guillermo's kind of more the more talkative one between Jaime and Guillermo. He's the more talkative brother and more sort of out there. And he said to me, you know, if you're ever going to Mexico, I have to come with you. And I said, all right, Guillermo, we'll see if that ever happens. And when I acquired the research money to do that, he was the first person I contacted. And I said, would you want to come with me to Mexico? And he says, absolutely. We'll use my hometown as a base there in Guanajuato, in a town called Charco de Pantoja in Guanajuato. And we'll go from there. And I said, great. So it was going to be just Guillermo and I. But then Guillermo said to me, Do you plan to carry all those cameras and equipment around with you everywhere we go? You know, he asked me that because I was always a one-man show carrying all these recording devices around with me, documenting as I was going. And I said, yeah, why? And he says, because I know someone there, a young lady who actually works for a local cable station. She's in my community. She knows my family very well, and she would really be great to have on this project. I said, let's get her. Let's bring her along. So I was able to pay her as well, a girl named Sandy Cano. She came out. And then he said, and we need a driver. You know, because I don't really know all of Mexico. I just know my area there, my state. He said, but, you know, I have a friend, a compadre, who his job is to drive around all of central Mexico, and he knows the roads. And I said, okay, let's get him. So then he came along. And then, of course, the very end, he said, as we were leaving pretty much now with his team, he said, and I saw this really sort of this 80-year-old man at the end of the road there as we're driving away from the town to go looking, to go researching. And he said, oh, by the way, Tim, I forgot to mention, my uncle, Don Leobardo, wants to come along, and he's not going to take no for an answer. So Don Leobardo was actually the nephew. Don Leobardo is 80, I don't want to say, he's probably about 85 now, maybe.
Now, when I say this scene, Tim, I see you roll your eyes at the prospect of this. I see you giving an eye roll. Oh, my gosh.
I didn't know what to expect, and I just knew that I had to be flexible with everything, and that was kind of my approach to the whole research project, you know. And Don Leobardo really came across to be a sort of a stroke of genius, I think, on behalf of, or just maybe just a really sort of fortuitous that we brought him, because every time we go to a new community, and we would be speaking, these would be cold calls. We'd be knocking on doors. People didn't expect us some of the times. And then here we are asking about a tragedy in our family that happened 70-something years ago. And they would be hesitant to share with us. For one, they didn't know who we were. They knew we were foreigners. They weren't sure who we were. But then Don Leobardo would come out. He'd hobble out, put his little hat on, and he'd put his arm around them and say, look, it was my uncle who was also killed in that airplane. Let's sit down and talk a little bit. And then sure enough, they'd open up. So it was just great that we brought him along, and everybody on that team was so vital, and I'm grateful to them. Yeah.
Well, now you mentioned some of these families that you're tracking down and have questions for, but you really didn't have, I mean, the names that you had were few, and a lot of them were wrong. For example, and this is reproduced on the cover of your book, that you have a piece of paper that has 28 lines on it, and where it says name of owner, this the names of these people you'd hope they would list, and every single line of those 28 lines just say Mexican national. And
that's right.
So how did you even find out who these people were when you couldn't rely on the names that you did find? For example, it was really interesting that there was a guy named Tomas who died on the plane mm-hmm. crash. But they had right. not known where Tomas ended and his next name began, and they wrote down Tomasa. Right. How did that right. come about?
Yeah, that's right. There were these kinds of discrepancies in the names, and I recognize that along with the time the cemetery director Carlos Rascon, who was helpful, who helped me locate those names. He and I both recognized that some of the names are wrong, and
Tomas like Aviña Tomas Aviña, and so you.
That's
had
right. It was his. That's right. His real name was Tomas Aviña, and they put it together as a woman, Tomasa.
So here's where your Sherlock Holmes.
Go ahead.
Here's where your Sherlock Holmes talent come in handy, Tim.
Here's what happened is that there were a few things that sort of really opened my eyes to the possibility of this being an erroneous list. One was that every newspaper account that I had read up to that point said that there was only one Mexican female passenger. And according to the list, there would have been three Mexican females, because Tomasa, one, Maria, two, and then Guadalupe. And they wrote the middle name Laura, like Laura, Guadalupe mm-hmm. Laura Ramirez. That would have been three female Mexican passengers. And I said, well, that doesn't work along the lines of what everybody reported, that there was only one. So that there's an error somewhere in there. And later on, when I found the first family, and they told me, yes, it was Guadalupe Lara, the last name, L-A-R-A. So they added the letter U and turned Guadalupe into a female, Laura, instead of Lara. And so we started right away knowing, okay, there are many other errors here. There's the name Apolonio Placenti. I have never heard that last name before, Placenti, but I have heard Placencia. That is a common last name in Mexico. So there were these things where I thought, okay, some of them were guesses, but I knew that some of them were errors, and so I had to figure out how to confirm the names. That was big to me.
So Placenti was not an Italian on board this plane, but
it was not the Italian on board that plane. No, not at all. Yeah, it sounded like it, but nope. And in fact, in the end, I learned that there was only one female Mexican passenger. That was Maria Santana Rodriguez, and then of course the only other female was Bobby Atkinson. One of the ways was that when I found the Ramirez family and they had that list of names, most of those names, I want to say with the exception of maybe two, but almost all those names were correct. They did write them correctly because they also had their surviving family members' names as well with them. So they had the correct list.
And one thing that was, from my point of view, Tim, that it was important for you to get these names is that you didn't want this just to be statistics, anything political. You wanted to make mm-hmm. these people human beings for us, the readers.
Yes.
You succeed in doing this, for example, just with mm-hmm. the pilot. You tracked down the story of this pilot and found out, why did he even become a pilot? And what was his story?
That's right. The story of the pilot, the story of Bobby Atkinson and her story, how her family, her mother's story. You know, to me, I felt like this story represented a wonderful opportunity, a very sincere opportunity to talk about how we as human beings have much more in common than we do differences. Mm-hmm. You know, we hear a lot of political rhetoric and rhetoric just sort of spread around that is meant to divide us as human beings, that's meant to create a kind of barrier between us, a divisiveness. And so I didn't want the book to fall into that category of political rhetoric. I wanted the book to survive and to exist mostly and primarily on the human element. So for me, it was just as important to find out Frank Atkinson's story and to lift that up into the light as it was to find out Guadalupe Ramirez Lara's story and lift that up into the light. To lift every passenger, every life that was taken in this terrible accident, lift them up so that we can all see the humanity, the people they loved, the things that they worked hard for, their dreams, equally across the board. That was my goal. So that way, you know, and here's the other thing is that omission to any part of society is not a good thing. You know, it's a terrible thing. Any kind of erasure of any one part of society is, you know, just not a good thing. And so I didn't want to perpetuate that same kind of, that same idea. If I was to only tell you the stories of the Mexican passengers, I would be doing the same thing, omitting the white passengers, the American crew members. And I didn't want to, you know, I felt like this has, there are 32 lives taken here, and all 32 were in one ship hurling toward a common fate together, none of them spared. So I wanted to lift all their lives up, as I think all of our lives in this real world should be lifted.
My guest is Tim Z. Hernandez. His novel is They All Will Call You. And I even hesitate to call it a novel because I think that doesn't convey the truth in your story. Mm-hmm. And maybe calling it a reenactment is more accurate. Mm-hmm. Because when you put together this information, you bring it to life for us, those of us reading this book. You even refer to it as a metaphor, the incident as a metaphor. How do you mean that, Tim?
That's what I was just explaining there is really the metaphor for everything, I think. You know, I mean, here were 32 different lives, 32 different scenarios. They came from different parts of Mexico, different parts of the United States, different backgrounds, different religious, beliefs, different, financial backgrounds. They had just all differences you can think of that we all do here on this big planet Earth. And here they are in this one ship, like I said, hurling toward a common fate. None of them were spared. None of them spared the same fate, and none of us will be spared that same fate, you know? And so I thought, what a better sort of a metaphor for what we all are here together. We're all in this together, you know, and we all deserve to have our stories told and our names at the end of the day. That was really what I was going for, and that's what I meant by that.
My guest is Tim Hernandez, and he has written a book of investigative journalism, All They Will Call You, which is this year's Book in Common. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm here with this year's Book in Common author, Tim Hernandez, and he will be in Lackson Auditorium on March 13th to discuss his research of a 1948 plane wreck in Los Gatos Canyon. Well, you actually come from an oral history background, don't you, Tim, that you're not focusing on the data, but you focused on the people and their stories. So did you come from an oral history background?
You know, I used to work. Well, first of all, the oral history background comes from my parents and my grandparents. You know, like I said, they were all migrant farm workers at one time. And we often kill time by sharing stories. You know, I heard so many stories growing up. So my family were big storytellers. My grandfather especially loved to tell stories. And then later on, in a more formal way, I got involved with the California Council for the Humanities. They're based out of the Bay Area. And I worked for them when they had this California Stories project in the early 2000s. And my job was to go around the San Joaquin Valley recording people's stories, collecting stories, interviewing people. So that was a big, major influence in the way that I began to look at the stories of my own community, the place I call home. And so for me then, you know, one of my idols is Studs Terkel, you know, who is one of the great oral historians, I feel. And you know, for me, I felt like, well, rather than talk about the data and the sort of quote-unquote facts of what happened, I want to tell this story to the people's voices. Let the oral testimony, the oral histories tell the story, and let that be valid enough, even if, and oftentimes, sometimes there were opposing accounts. You know, someone remembered the plane exploding. Another person said it never exploded. You know, even these opposing accounts were valid because each of us has a different perception when we experience these things. And that is the humanity within us. That's the stuff I said. I want that to be on the page. I want that to tell the story. So that's really what I was trying to do with that. But yes, very much an oral history background.
Well, how much help, people might say, well, what about the wreckage, the plane crash? Could you get information from the plane crash to help you out?
Yeah, you know what? That is probably actually the most sort of quote unquote factual part of the story is really, you know, I used a lot of the data for the plane crash itself because I wanted to obviously reconstruct it in a way that was authentic and realistic to the situation. I wanted it to show what really happened. I got the accident reports from the civil aeronautics board, and I got their accident report. I got accident reports from the newspaper accounts that were there. And then I also consulted with two pilots who've flown the Douglas DC-3, you know, for many, many, many years. And I showed them the accident reports, and they kind of spoke with me a little bit about, you know, what might have happened, what they think could have done here, how the pilot might have reacted in this situation. So they kind of spoke to me about all of this. I showed them the pilot's background and experiences, and they kind of had a real good assessment and informed me a lot about anything to do with the airplane itself. I learned more about airplanes than I ever thought I would need to.
Well, and it's a story that you mentioned, the pilot. It was not like he was coerced into becoming a pilot. He really wanted to be a pilot. And even they said at first, yeah, well, your eyesight's not good enough. You can't be a pilot. But he wanted to be a pilot. And then the story of his wife, Bobby, we think, well, they met. They were high school sweethearts. They met and they lived happily until this plane crash. But the story was more realistic than that. He had this other high school sweetheart before Bobby and he got married.
Right. That's right. He was set to marry a woman named Dorothy. And that was the woman that his family and sister said that everybody thought that he was going to for sure marry Dorothy, but that's not how it worked out once he left for World War II. Frankie as his family refers to him, you know, since he was a little boy, he knew what he wanted to do. He wanted to be a pilot, and his eyesight was terrible, so he ate carrots. And all of those anecdotes that we talk about, that I write about in the book, and some of them really funny, in fact.
Many carrots.
Were things that the family told me. Yeah, the family
told me. He turned carrot color. His family was concerned that he was
turned to skin orange, all these things, you know, and one of the things that I loved, probably, you know, the pilot's family was concerned when I first contacted them with how I was going to portray Frankie. All the families were. They were all concerned with how I'd portray the family members. But the pilot's family, I think, probably mostly because they were concerned because, you know, the plane, right after the accident, the people in charge, the people who were looking at the incident, who were doing the investigations, and the airline itself was trying to place blame on the pilot. And so the family was really concerned that would sort of come back to haunt them. And and when they read the way I wrote about Frankie, they just loved it. They felt honored. And that was one of the big achievements for me. I felt good. This is how I want every family that I write about in this book to feel. And that has been the case. One of the things that surprised me most, when I first gave the book to Jaime Ramirez, when it finally came out, Mr. Ramirez read it. And he contacted me, and I said to him, you know, how did you feel about it? And he says, you know, I love the stories. He says, you know, one of my favorite stories, and this surprised me. He said, one of my favorite stories is the story of the pilot. Mm-hmm. And I said, why is that? And he said, because he's the one I probably could relate to the most. And isn't that interesting?
Yes.
You know? And I said, why is that, Jaime? Why do you relate to pilot Frank Atkinson? And he says, because during the Depression, he did whatever it took to raise money for his family, to help his family. And I have done that myself.
Well, one thing that impressed in the pilot story is that often I feel we get a romanticized view of World War II, that everybody got along, marriages held together, and everything for the war cause. And I thought it was realistic that when Frank goes to Dorothy, that everybody thought he was going to marry, and he says, well, I'm off I'm enlisted in the military. Yeah. And she says, well, hey, wait a minute. I'm not going to sit here and wait on you. And I thought, that's probably happened often. And yet we don't hear those kinds of stories.
That's right. That's right. That was one of the hardest, you know, one of the difficult things that for me anyways, when you're writing about other people who really existed. And I did the same thing with my previous novel, Mañana Means Heaven, where I was writing about one woman. And in this case, writing about 32 different lives. One of the most difficult things is writing the truth, is writing the flaws that we have as people also, or writing the kind of, you know, the raw truths, the things that we don't feel, the things that we're ashamed of even, you know. And so that's one of the things that, you know, in this book I had to put in there was, you know, how did these things really happen? And not just with Frank Atkinson, but I try and do that with every passenger. There are flaws. We're human beings. That's also part of our human element. But that's always difficult to write because you're trying to honor these folks at the same time, you know. But it has to be a realistic portrayal. Otherwise, you know, nobody would believe it. It'd be a very one-dimensional narrative. And so In the case of Frank Atkinson, that's right. That's how it happened. And then, of course, in the case of some of the other passengers, there are other things, too, that very difficult decisions that would have to be made along the way, sacrifices.
My guest is Tim Z. Hernandez. His book is All They Will Call You, and it is a documentary novel or historical novel. And this process of putting this together, you don't really have a template, I don't think, Tim, to do this. Mm. You had to kind of make it up as you went along. And so I think you mentioned at some point that the process of putting this together was messy, your word.
Yeah, that's right. It was messy, because, again, this is, one of the books that is kind of, I think, along these lines as well as Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, in which he does something very similar. The difference with In Cold Blood is that Truman Capote, when that happened, that incident happened that he writes about, happened in his time. So he was able to access information immediately. You know, he could interview the people that are around that community, all that. And in the case of even another one of my idols as well, Luis Alberto Urrea, who wrote a wonderful book called The Devil's Highway, it happened also within his time. So he was able to access that information. With me, it's very difficult because it happened long before I was born. You know, it happened 70 years before I was, even around to think about this story. And so getting information was very difficult. And when I did find people and interview them, memory is also very elusive. So there were a lot of gaps and a lot of sort of circular thinking. You know, there was not really a sort of, I could think chronologically from A to Z. It had been so long ago that everybody just kind of was able to share what they could remember of things. And so I had to find, and then there was also pieces of documents and information that just came sporadically and broken in fragments. And then I thought to myself early on, well, that's how you might stumble upon a plane crash, right? You would come upon it and there would be fragments of things, fragments of stories, fragments of lives, fragments of information. And so I have to find a way to allow those fragments to kind of exist that way in this book. So the story in the book is told in a very, I give you the time sequences, but they're broken up. You know, it happens here, time jumps back and forth. There's also, but you're getting, ideally, every time you find a piece of fragment that you're reading about, you're finding the love, the humanity, the laughter, the joy, the light, and all of these disparate pieces. And at the end of the book, my hope is that as the reader, you will have enough information to include sort of your own humanity, your own life, your own experiences, sort of to be in conversation with this book and feel like you were able to get what the book is about. That was the goal.
Well, at the end of your book, you have what you call field notes from 2012 to 2015, mm-hmm. and you have a quote, "Here, where the world is undone and their bodies are remade, their spirits rise in star-flecked spirals. The pooling blood runs backwards. Their splintered hearts come together. I know all their names. I will call them, and they will come." Why did you choose that quote, Tim?
Gosh, that is still a moving quote for me when I hear it read back. The poet is Irene Lara Silva, who wrote that. And she is a fantastic poet based out of Austin, Texas, whose work I just admire greatly. And I had been trying to find a way to conclude it, to kind of put a bow tie at the end of the book. And a kind of a closure. And so I looked to a lot of books and a lot of writers for just something that resonated. And to me, when I read that, and in fact, that comes from her book. I think the book is titled Flesh to Bone or something like that, Flesh to Bone. And when I read that excerpt, I said, this is it. This is exactly what belongs at the end of this book. I will call their names and they will come. This idea of now we know who they are. And now we can invoke them. And we know that they were human beings, that they are present. As they say in Latin America, presente, they are now present with us.
Well, you wrote their story in a book, but you were not content just to write their story, Tim. What did you mm-hmm. do with these? What did you do with this? What you learned about this incident? I'm thinking in particular now when you go to the cemetery and you see that the cemetery register it says in the cemetery register, allow one line for each grave. And the names weren't known. They just said Mexican National. This was the Holy Cross Cemetery catalog from January 31st, 1948. And what did you do to help honor these people who lost their lives on that date?
It was really a tragedy and very moving to stand, as it is when you walk in any cemetery, but to stand at a plot where underneath this earth, in this giant blank space of lawn, where there's nothing there except this giant square of lawn, patch of lawn, and underneath you standing there are 28 caskets with the remains of unknown people, right, of these anonymous pastors, families, 28 families back home who didn't know what happened to their relatives, who have no idea where they're buried. It is moving. And all it was now was a placard there, a small placard that read something to the effect of 28 Mexican nationals killed in a plane crash, 1948, rest in peace, something to that effect. Very anonymous still. It was just moving. And so I asked the cemetery director, what would it take to put names on a headstone right here? And he said it would take, well, confirm the names first. He says then it would take money and permission from the bishop, and that's it. And so I said, okay, you work on permission of the bishop. I will find the names. And then together we'll all work on the money. And he did. He got permission from the bishop, and then I confirmed the names. And then one of the original ideas for this is actually because I was collaborating with a good friend of mine, Lance Canales, who's a fantastic musician, and I encourage you to look up his video. He did a music video of this song because he recorded this song in a way it has never been recorded before. Lance Canales, and I'm in the background reading the names of the people behind his music. It's a great video. Lance and I had thought, well, why don't we install this headstone? So I was moving forward now and speaking with the cemetery about it. And once I had the names confirmed and they had the permission from the bishop there at Holy Cross Cemetery in Fresno, Lance and I got busy right away with raising the funds. And they said it would take about $10,000, $10,000 to $12,000 to install a big headstone. It had to be a 4x8 slab of granite, the kind that they used to bury the bishops in. And it was going to be an Italian granite import. And it was just this huge slab. It had to be big because it was going to put all these names on there. And it was also going to put the incident of what happened in Spanish and English. So we finally raised actually $14,000 in a span of 3 months. And the highest, this is probably a source of pride for me, the highest check was probably about $200, I believe. Everything else was $20 here, $50 there, $100 here. Children sending in piggy banks from as far away as like Italy, Australia. People were donating from around the world because they had been singing this song about this incident for the last 50-some years in different languages all around the world. And I got all these wonderful letters and you know, postcards from everybody just thanking me for finally finding these names of these folks. And so we used that money. On Labor Day of 2013, we installed the headstone there before an audience of, oh gosh, about 1,000 people. And the family, some of the family members of those who I had found at that time were there present to, you know, to find closure. And so we installed that headstone. And today, what's really, I think, a smart move on the cemetery's part is that they kept that original placard that was anonymous. They kept it in the foundation. So when you visit Holy Cross today, you can actually see the original placard there saying 28 Mexican nationals. And then you can see the giant headstone now that has all of their names. It has the incident in English and Spanish. And then around the whole perimeter, around the edges of the headstone are 32 leaves for Woody Guthrie's song when he sings, "Who are these friends all scattered like dry leaves?" So it's 32 leaves. And we put the names of all 32 passengers, not just the 28 Mexican passengers, but also the four American crew members.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, beautiful tribute.
It is beautiful. And thank you for that tribute and for this book as tribute, Tim.
Thank you.
My guest has been Tim Z. Hernandez. He is the author of this year's Book in Common, and his book is All They Will Call You.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.